give you some insight, I can absolutely guarantee you that via whatever method they want to choose, whether it's, you know, sort of techniques that people are familiar with now that sort of come into common parlance, like CRISPR or other sort of gene shuttling mechanisms, or even just through sort of crossbreeding or cross-infecting in animals themselves. So if you've got a colony of monkeys and you give them at the same time rabies, smallpox, and SARS, for example, and you wait to see how the cell cooks that up in a way that you don't know what's coming out the crazy conveyor belt at the end. And, you know, I would probably, you know, my hedging my bet, I would say that's what happened in Wuhan, that it was, well, there's no difference between a research virus versus a weaponized virus. It's just scale.
For those of you who are just joining us, this is Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain, and I'm here with Dr. Kevin McCairn, PhD, and he is going to get us up to date on some of the health risks that may be a little bit underplayed with regards to coronavirus, the CCP virus, COVID-19, COVID-2, SARS-19, something, and it seems to have more names than the Aztec anthology of Welsh gods, but we'll try and keep it fairly straight. So I do appreciate, of course, everybody who's going to drop by and say hello. And just sort of the background as to why, when Dr. McCairn reached out to me, I mean, I was very interested, of course, because of his expertise, 20 years in neuroscience, 20 plus years in neuroscience, but also because I really do have the feeling, and I know having a feeling is not an argument, but I really do have the feeling that there's stuff out there in what is known in the world that is not necessarily being wildly communicated to us. If you look at the elites and how they don't generally respond with great alarm, even to very dangerous things, you know, like hundreds of thousands of little British girls getting raped by immigrants, they tend to kind of brush that under the rug. So I always kind of had the feeling, rightly or wrongly, that there was more that was going on in terms of health dangers than what had been communicated to us. And so when Dr. McCairn contacted me and said, you might be right. Well, of course, you know, anyone who tells me I'm right has my immediate attention and eternal loyalty. No, I'm just kidding. But I, of course, have had some doctors and experts with a variety of views of the dangers of coronavirus on the show. And I wanted to give you this perspective because I am a big one for, expertise. I don't do my own teeth. I don't do my own surgery, and I don't do my own evaluation of coronavirus's effect on the central nervous system. It's not something I'm sort of plotting out in my basement with a fork and a blowtorch. So I really do appreciate your time here. I hope you don't mind if we're on a first basis, Kevin. It's really a great pleasure to have you. And of course, it's going to be a little sluggish from the video side because we are contacting each other from, well, opposite sides of the world, but I really do appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Stefan, thank you very much and giving me this opportunity.
If you could give the listeners a little bit about your background, your history, and your role at the university, the ResearchGate work and all of that, that would be great. And of course, I'll put the links to all of your work and your YouTube channel and all of that below.
Mm-hmm. So like I say, as Stefan said, I have 20 plus years research experience, and that's gone from postgraduate to having my own lab.
What is the issue with COVID-19, coronavirus, and the central nervous system? Because all we've really heard about is, you know, it's going to hit your lungs. I've talked to other doctors who said that it's going to plug into receptors elsewhere in your body. Mm. I haven't heard much about the central nervous system, so I wonder if you could lay out what you have understood in that area.
Yeah, so the in a nutshell is that ever since SARS broke onto the scene, the virologists knew that there was a what they call a neurotrophic component to virus, which means it's able to latch on to receptors and basically in a retrograde, meaning go backwards up an axon and infect cell bodies. And they've sort of shown over the years that this infection or this virus has the capacity to jump transsynaptically. So once in the nervous system, once it's sort of traveled up the spinal cord. So the first videos I made were saying that COVID attacks the central nervous system and destroys an area of the brain called Botzinger complex, which is in the medulla, which is your brainstem. And I was, you know, my suspicions had been aroused because I'd seen what looked like Tourette-isms coming out of China. And, you know, that sort of tuned me into the fact that, well, it may have a mechanism similar to rabies in terms of how it sort of propagates in the central nervous system. It might not be as pathogenic as rabies. So it might sort of lie somewhere between measles and rabies with respect to how lethal it is. But one of the things that we're seeing right now is that, and I did a very long stream today because there was, and this, his videos are a couple of days old from New York, and it's literally an ICU medic who is literally just sort of imploring people with, you know, a few hundred subscribers that there is a something going on with COVID that they don't understand as medics that are geared towards treating viral pneumonia. He said that, in his words, I'm paraphrasing, it looks something akin to sort of altitude, like they're being taken up to very high altitude and they're not getting enough oxygen with their breathing. And so Botzinger complex in the brainstem is involved in the rhythmicity of your breathing, right? So as myself and yourself are speaking to each other, you don't think about your breathing, right? There's a pacing that goes with it. And like I say, and it's geared on the chemistry of your blood and reflexes themselves. And there's a rhythmic component to that activity that enables you to breathe without thinking about it. If you get an infection in there, what's going to happen is that rhythmicity is going to be disrupted.
In there meaning the part of the brain that regulates breathing or automates breathing?
Yeah, so Botzinger complex.
This is the people who are, it's so weird because it reminds me of a very old Flintstones cartoon that I watched as a kid where he gets a virus where he can't fall asleep and they have to kind of keep him up. So these are the people who are scared to fall asleep because they're afraid that they're going to forget, in a sense, how to breathe.
Yes, very much so. And so there was a very important paper came out as a sort of rapid communication in, let's say, Journal of Virology right now. And the reason I sort of paid attention to it was because one of the authors was affiliated with one of the institutes that I'm affiliated with, Riken in Japan. And, you know, that institute has its own problems. And we could spend a whole episode talking about that. I usually get a lot of papers across my desk, so I still review stuff because people ask me to do it and they request me. And I get a lot of papers that come from Chinese authors, and usually I'm sort of skeptical in a way, often because the results often just seem too good. And that's how the stats were looking with respect to China, as the death toll and the afflicted were mounting up. And so I just had a lot of suspicions. And this one, they mentioned this brain region because SARS as a virus was known to be expressed in that region. But the problem being that most medics are going to see or think SARS viral pneumonia. They're not going to think viral neurotroph like rabies. That's the problem. And like I say, if people go to, I don't know, people said that my stream got taken down straight away today. I don't know if that's true or not, but there's you can get on my Discord. There's a Discord is public right now, and there's a lot of links in there if people want to sort of follow up what I'm saying. There is a paper trail in this case, and
well, and should something happen to this stream, one of mine vanished. Of course, YouTube has a lot of automation that's going on at the moment, and not a lot of manual review. So people can find this dlive.tv/freedomain. So dlive.tv/freedomain. People can follow this if it should happen to vanish from YouTube, which I guess won't help people if they're on YouTube, but they can't hear this. But anyway, for those of you who are listening, so okay, so the virus. Let's start like real, you know, explain it to me like I'm 5 years old, right? Mm-hmm. So the virus is an RNA thing. It's, you know, not even really considered a life form. It's sheathed in a kind of fat. It gets into your system. It plugs into receptors. Then what?
So then it will unravel itself. So the protein coat will be shed and the lipid protection around the viral code, its genetic makeup, which in this case is RNA, will be injected into the cytoplasm of the cell. And there are things called ribosomes in the cell, which are geared towards taking messenger RNA from the cell nucleus and encoding it into proteins and elements that the cell needs for functioning. And that can, like I say, that could be fixed hormones to neurotransmitters to, you know, the list is potentially endless as you would sort of rattle through it. But once inside the cell, it can hijacks the ribosomes and then begins to sort of replicate in such a way that it then gets encapsulated again and then gets shuttled out or along the axon of the neuron, if we're speaking about the central nervous system, and then it'll jump to the targets around the cell body. So it could cause the cell to, it's called lysis. So the cell will sort of burst once the sort of viral load gets high enough, or it can, if they're, so the brain is a specialized region, so it's called immunoprivileged. So the blood-brain barrier is there to sort of act as a stopgap to most pathogens getting in. And most medics would sort of, that would be where their knowledge would sort of stop, unless they're sort of familiar with things like rabies, as an example. I'm using rabies because, one, most people are familiar with it, and two, I would put the hypothesis forward that you're seeing some sort of progression through the central nervous system like you do with rabies. But in the case of rabies, I think what you tend to see is more that it actually physically destroying the individual neurons within a network. And potentially what you've got with the COVID virus is that it, instead of just lysing the cell, it's just enough to sort of keep hijacking and shedding neurons into a network and sort of spreading where it needs to go. And then occasionally it would sort of flip into a sort of more pathogenic mode. And so a good example of the peripheral nervous system is shingles, herpes zoster, that would have a so a lot of the time you don't have it, and then for whatever reason, it just sort of decides to rear its ugly head at a particular moment. And I'm guessing, well, I'm hypothesizing that the same is true with COVID.
So what does this mean for the progression of the illness? And are you saying that COVID can cross the barrier and then start going at the brain?
Yes. Yeah. So the blood-brain barrier is essentially includes all the spinal cord and the dura mater around the brain. And so it's an extended structure across the whole of the body. Right. And so if there's a retrograde component to the virus itself, in theory, you could prick it into the end of your big toe. And it would travel up the the motor or sensory axon all the way up to the spinal cord, make the jump, because there's a synapse in the spinal cord itself that receives sensory and motor input, and that's where sort of basic reflexes come from, okay, the sort of activation of that circuit. Once in there, so it's already got into the nervous system by traveling up the axon from your big toe, it's coming towards the spinal cord, it makes the jump into the spinothalamic tracts, and these go right up to the brain. But there's a added extra complication here, that one of the weakest points where COVID can attack is the oral mucosa in the brain, in the nasal passages. And by transfecting the sensory nerve endings that enable you to smell, it travels to a region called the olfactory bulb. And from the olfactory bulb, it's another synapse into a region called the basal ganglia. And these are a collection of deep nuclei in the mid and forebrain. That's kind of what goes wrong in Tourette's and Parkinson's. And so that's where the spitting and the impulsivity is what I saw that stood out for me, rather than... So when someone's ill and they feel feverish, they tend to get lethargic almost with temperature and fever, because you don't feel well and your body says you need to shut down.
Yeah, I mean, I've had that occasionally where you just lie in bed, you're not alert or awake enough to do anything, but you're not actually kind of asleep. It's kind of this weird no time situation, like you're kind of lost in space, like you kind of look up and it's like, oh wow, 2 hours have gone by.
Yeah.
And you just lie there in this sort of Raskolnikovian kind of half world between sleep and waking. And it's actually kind of cool in a way, because it keeps your energy low, which is good because you keep your activity low, but also it helps pass the time until you get better, because it's a little bit of a waiting game with this stuff.
Yes, yeah. And so if we're dealing with a situation where the primary route of infection is the central nervous system first, because it's, let's go the nasal route, and the virus is hijacking the brain in a way that they don't have the respiratory symptoms that people are defining the disorder by. And potentially what you have then is I was tongue in cheek calling them COVID zombies, and just in sort of deference to a person who I'm sure your listeners like listening to as well, is Jim Metcalfe. I think he's really funny. He does a really funny podcast, and one of his themes is the global pestilence pandemic, and he coined the term Corona-chan as the name for COVID. And I sort of took it from there, that once the transfection has got into the basal ganglia, this region is responsible for the automatic components to behavior. Okay, so say for example I'm talking to you, but I know I've got a cup in front of me, I can reach for the cup and guide my action in such a way and make the decision to do that through the aid of these nuclei called the basal ganglia, as a layman's approach. And like I say, when they go wrong when you're old, you can't move. And in the other case, in youngsters, when the nervous system is being primed, you get involuntary behaviors. And like I said, that's what I saw. That was the marker for me.
Does it kick in around, I don't know what the technical term is, that I would sort of call it the third eye or the observing ego, the part of you that looks at yourself and says, well, how am I behaving relative to my values, relative to good behavior, relative to my standards, relative to what is socially acceptable? I don't know if you'd call it the shame brain or something like that.
Brain's good.
Yeah, does it kick in and disinhibit people from social norms? I guess, is that a potential scenario?
Yeah, absolutely the potential scenario. And that's precisely what you're seeing. And so the most striking video footage coming out of China were the people that were going in and spitting onto, whether it be buttons in an elevator because they think no one's watching, or the drinks in a store if they think.
Or I've seen a woman, it was a Chinese woman, opening and closing and rubbing her hands on the keyboards in a computer store. So when people come and test the keyboards, they then get the virus that way.
Yeah. So all those types of things can be. So OCD type behaviors are manifested through this network as well. So you have to think of the virus once transfecting. It's sort of, you have to think of it as shunting the network to a readiness state that under normal circumstances would take more steps to get to. And then from its altered baseline, then comes the jump to the automatic behaviors. So the spit reflex being this one that I sort of home in on as being the critical factor for this. So as a virus, you want to be able to spread as far as you can without people really knowing that you're sick, right? So the virus wants carriers, right? And so if someone's coughing, people instinctively have a sort of revulsion to that type of behavior, especially if you're on planes or trains. And a lot of the footage that I was seeing earlier on was coming from aeroplanes. Okay, so people sort of flipping out on an aeroplane, and usually, you know, people flip out on aeroplanes, that's normal. But it's the spitting that came, right? And I was like, oh yeah, that to me just sort of was the sort of nail in the coffin that said, I need to do something, because there is this dereliction of duty that I don't know what you're like for time, but I would literally just start reading out the people who need to be held to account. And I would start right from the top with, you could probably forgive the president of the United States right now, because he can't know everything. He defers to experts, but people like
Well, he was also dealing with a massive impeachment coup attempt for many years that happened to overlap with the start of this virus, which of course puts at least some of the blame on the lap of the Democrats. Not that they'll ever take any blame. They seem to lack that observing ego and the shame brain aspect of things. But yeah, there was a lot that was going on that was going to be somewhat distracting.
Yeah. So as I sort of watched this theater of absurd begin to commence, the one thing that really, you know, boiled my blood, I'll try not to swear too much, was the press conference by the Surgeon General when it was understood that it was arriving in the United States at a sort of large enough scale that it was going to be difficult to fudge it with numbers with respect to flu or other respiratory illnesses. Okay. And in that press meeting, the Surgeon General, Jerome Adams, stood up and went in front of the American people and the world, because the world still looks to the United States for guidance somewhat. And there hadn't been any guidance coming from the East. We can get into that as well. But he stood up there and unflinchingly said to the public, you don't need masks, and generally you're too stupid to even know how to use a mask properly. Literally, those were his words. I'm paraphrasing. But that's what was said. And as a consequence of that, I would just say there was a neglect put into the strategic posture of the West that has enabled this pathogen to get a foothold, that had the statistics been correct from the beginning and the reporting been correct from the beginning, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
Oh, I mean, we could probably do an entire show on how COVID-1984, it seems to be becoming, how it is largely a government-engineered crisis. I mean, whatever we think of in terms of the origins, the fact that the Chinese Communist Party shut down debate, wouldn't let the World Health Organization in, although that may be a benefit given how the WHO is acting these days, jailed doctors, threw dissidents into gulags for talking about it, you let 5 million people get out of Wuhan, didn't close their airports, let it go around the world, and then went around the world scooping up medical equipment and taking it back to China, and then also shipping not only ineffective but also infected masks and other kinds of protective equipment around the world, surgical masks and so on. I mean, and then, of course, not closing. Apparently, you can close the economy later, but you can't close the borders to begin with. I mean, it's all completely mad. They downplay it in order to help it spread, and then they completely crush the economy. I mean, you really couldn't be working harder to wreck America, to wreck the West, to wreck the world as a whole. It is really like watching people with detonators go into a building and call themselves architects.
Right. Again, you won't get any argument from me in that respect. And like I say, there are people, if I could work it out, then I'm pretty sure that intelligence agencies and people that had boots on the ground all through this knew what was coming. And, you know, what looks like a sort of slow burn 9/11, and I would make the argument that it's even worse than 9/11 because the numbers, the immediate death toll, or the cumulative death toll, is much, much higher than 9/11. That was a one-day event. The knock-on consequences we are of course, still dealing with, but the stuttering and the willful blindness. I want to think it was just ignorance. And I think there's the saying about, you know, don't ascribe malice where stupidity will do.
Well, I'm not. You know, that may be your perspective, Kevin, and obviously you're welcome to it, but. No, if you put yourself forward as an expert, you should know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah.
And when you've got people like Dr. Fauci in January saying, oh, it's, you know, it's not going to be a big deal for Americans, nothing for them to worry about. It's not going to have much effect. Yes, it's serious, but it's not going to be a big deal for America. It's like, well, that's a pretty important thing to get wrong. You know, that's a pretty important thing, because if this guy who has, you know, the ear of the president and so on, if he was able to make the case in a public and compelling manner about the danger of this damn thing early on, then there might have been enough outrage and momentum to close the borders, in which case America, and we know this, if China had just closed its airports, it would have mitigated 95% of the impact of coronavirus. It would be localized. It would be much easier to deal with. There could be very decisive measures put in place to tamp it down. Now, of course, there is the long-run problem, which we can talk about this genie being out of the bottle and it ain't going back in, Robin Williams style. So how are we going to deal with that? But yeah, for sure, to me, it's fine if some, you know, idiot in a chat window says, well, it's just like the flu. It's like, well, he's just some idiot in a chat window, right? You're supposed to take anyone seriously. But when people are specifically paid and taking millions or hundreds of millions or billions of dollars of taxpayers' money to keep taxpayers safe and claim a string of alphabet soup credentials after their name and put the doctor in front, and it counts for you too, right? But the reality is that they do have an obligation to A, be correct, and B, if they're incorrect, to humbly apologize and tell everyone what went wrong. Like, for instance, I'd love to see the actual algorithms and the source data behind all of this modeling that's going so wrong, right? I mean, that open it up, open source, man, come on.
Yeah, and all of that needs to be transparent now. And again, like I say, if I've with the heavy artillery that you bring to my message, I would, you know, I don't have a hesitation in calling out who we need to call out. And one is Fauci, and I would just... he knows who he is, and I hope he's listening. He sort of filled me in a lot with respect to the history of Fauci, who's been there in the background since the Reagan administration. He's the epitome of what I would call a deep state actor. And those were his words spoken by the Surgeon General when they told the people, you don't need masks. Masks won't help you. And masks very much will help you. And you're going to get some smart ass say, well, you need an N95 or an N100 mask. And I would say, well, yeah, maybe if you're dealing with the ill 24/7. But actually right now, 99% of the population, whilst people like ourselves, Stefan, who are just Joe Public at the end of the day, have to sort of make decisions for your family, for the people that you care about, and so on and so forth. You need to be able to have some degree of predictive capacity to understand what's going on. And when they say no masks, how many people turned around and said it's not necessary? right? And even now, they're still doing it. And right now, the CDC is considering reversing its current stance, but it's too slow. It's too slow right now, and it needs to happen right now. And they need to, the injunction needs to be shelter in place. And when you need to go out, which is to get your supplies that you need, so I don't know, milk, eggs, fresh stuff that you can get hold of, you need something as a barrier that stops you touching around your nose and mouth. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but Chris Martinson kind of clued people into this. It's sort of three basic reasons that you need to wear masks. Number one, of course, it prevents the aerosol spray from your cough and your sneeze. Number two, it doesn't eliminate it, but it reduces it. Number two, as you point out, it reminds you to stop touching your face. And number three, it reduces the dosage of the virus, which is really, really important. You think about people getting or not getting the virus. Well, it's the difference between winged by a shotgun and getting one straight to the chest, yes. Right? So a smaller dose of the virus is much easier for your immune system to clear. A larger dose of the virus can easily tsunami-like overwhelm you, mm-hmm. and then you're in serious trouble. So those three things are very important, and it's almost incomprehensible as to why this basic, sensible precaution. I mean, when I was in Hong Kong last fall shooting my documentary, I mean, masks were everywhere. And this mm-hmm. was prior to the rollout, so to speak, of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you would just say to people that they're not necessary is, I don't even know what to say, other than it appears to have a specifically murderous intent. I mean, you're going to get people killed.
Yes. That would be my take on it. And everything that you said is right for the reasons to be wearing a mask. But I would just add that what we do know happened during the as the CDC and the Surgeon General and all those organizations which are supposed to kick in are speaking to the public at large, what we do know is that the CDC was requisitioning medical supplies for themselves, so what they considered to be essential personnel, and the decision was made that they'll handle what comes down the line, and that someone's calculated the losses, right? At some point, there's some algorithm and network, you know, chugging along that's giving them sort of up to the minute sort of predictions. And a decision was made that they will tell the people not to bother. They don't, and you know, what they're trying to do is stop the onset of panic, right? Because the mask wearing sort of increases the idea in the Western mind that there is something really pathogenic about this new thing that we're seeing. And you know, again, you know, it might just be stupidity, but you know, you can't rule out malice.
You are a very, very nice young man. It is wonderful to be in the presence of such benevolent optimism. I don't happen to share that benevolent optimism. You may be right. I hope you're right that they just don't want to start a panic. Well, I don't. I think, you know, the fact that people can't pay the rent, the fact that people are out of work, the fact that the economy is collapsing around us might be some indication that a panic is underway. I think there are a couple of things. I think that the moment they tell people to start wearing masks, people want to go and get masks. And what mm-hmm. will they find? There aren't any masks. And mm-hmm. that's going to be a big issue. And the second thing, which is supposition, of course, but it's based upon very clear historical facts, which is that when governments can't pay their bills, they tend to eliminate excess population. Mm-hmm. This is well known throughout history. You promise the world to everyone, particularly in a democracy, oh, you can have all the pensions and free healthcare and subsidized wages and all of this kind of stuff. We're going to just spend. And then when the bill comes due, traditionally, what governments do is they go to war. Right, they go to war, kills off a bunch of population, and then they just reset. In other words, you can borrow your way into future elimination. Now, I'm not saying this is anybody's plan. I'm not saying it's conscious, but there is this particular historical pattern. So for me, I mean, the Chinese Communist Party is one of the, if not the worst mass murderer in the history of the planet. So when people say, well, what you're saying, it could be some kind of bioweapon, but that would harm their own population. It's like, hello, this is the communism. That's their, that's number one on their job resume, willing to harm and kill millions of their own people. And so the idea that a virus gets out that eliminates people dependent on the state who are very expensive to the state, the frail, the infirm, the diabetic, the obese, the elderly, and so on. Again, I'm not saying any of this is plotted. I'm not saying any of this is planned. But it's the kind of thing where, you know, well, it's true, it is a global pandemic. But boy, it might help solve some of our unfunded liabilities. I just think that kind of cooks down there because it's really incomprehensible as to how anti-productive, anti-help, anti-safety, anti-healthcare the responses have all been. I'm just putting that out there as the rant. I'm not saying I've proven anything. I'm just saying there's a lot of historical precedent.
The precedent is, I would argue, overwhelming in that sense. And like I say, I'm being on my best behavior with respect to the words that I'm using right now, which is, yeah, if you were to speak to me privately, I would be much more... be much more direct with my language is how I would put it. And the simple fact of the matter is that this, you know, once herd immunity is established, and that's what they're going for, make no bones about it.
Okay, so let's, sorry, just to break that one out a little bit more. We've got quite a number of people watching who probably kind of knew. So herd immunity, what's the story there?
So herd immunity is where basically the percentage of your population has a natural or built-up immunity to the pathogen, that any sort of losses are minimized. So it would be the elderly or the very, well, God forbid it's the young, but you hope it's the elderly going first rather than the young. And but generally, the population is robust enough to withstand any sort of onslaught by a pathogen. And there's herd immunity to many things already, right? So one of them being measles. So that was achieved through vaccinations, and the smallpox is another. So, you know, we've gone a long way to eradicating smallpox. I mean, one of the few places left with smallpox are these BSL-4 laboratories.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, to give you some insight, I can absolutely guarantee you that via whatever method they want to choose, whether it's, you know, sort of techniques that people are familiar with now that sort of come into common parlance, like CRISPR, or other sort of gene shuttling mechanisms, or even just through sort of crossbreeding or cross-infecting in animals themselves. So if you've got a colony of monkeys and you give them at the same time rabies, smallpox, and SARS, for example, and you wait to see how the cell cooks that up in a way that, you know, you don't know what's coming out the crazy conveyor belt at the end. And, you know, I would probably, you know, my hedging my bet, I would say that's what happened in Wuhan, that it was, well, there's no difference between a research virus versus a weaponized virus. It's just scale. And one of those viruses.
Okay, hang on, sorry, I just wanted to open, there seemed like quite a bit to unpack in that rather casual statement. So there's no difference functionally. I mean, in terms of like a research virus, you're going to manipulate, you're going to edit it and so on. So I can understand that. But in the intent, right, if you wanted to create a bioweapon virus, and everyone thinks that the virus, a bioweapon virus would be designed to attack and kill people. So at least that's not, you know, if I had an evil twin, that's not how I would design a virus. I would design a virus kind of similar to what COVID-19 is, in that it has a very long gestation period, that people are asymptomatic, that it disables people, it debilitates people. In other words, it's a virus that attacks the economy through people. The central goal is the economy. Of course, it disables we've got two aircraft carriers in America who are disabled at the moment functionally because of this thing. And the other thing that I would do is I would try and get it across the blood-brain barrier so that it would disinhibit people and thus be something they would have them engage in activities that would help spread it in an odd way. So I'm not saying it is a weapon. I don't know. Nobody does. But this is just a misconception. Well, it doesn't have a high lethality rate. It's like, well, it does to the economy. That's going to have secondary splash damage on people's survivability. And of course, you do want to overwhelm the healthcare system if you want to design this kind of weapon, because then there's a lot of splash damage from people who otherwise will need it for various ailments and problems. And, you know, they all say this, oh, we've only canceled elective surgery. Well, it's not a hobby, people. People really do need those surgeries. So when you say functionally, like through gene editing, through CRISPR, the same process is used to research viruses to create a bioweapon. But if you did want to create a bioweapon, sorry, I asked a question. I'm going on a rant here. The question is coming up. I apologize for
that. No, you carry on.
So if you are editing a virus, you would be doing the same process. It would be the same process, but the design goal would probably be different. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to double check on that so people could be clear about that. At least I could be clear about it. So. Mm-hmm. Now, you were just in the middle of a thought. I rudely interrupted you because I try not to be dragged along without comprehension behind technical terms. If you wanted to finish your thought, I thought we could take a couple of cues from the audience.
I guess if I had to, you know, if this was a 30-second wrap-up and this was Fox News, I would I would finish with this, that Fauci, Surgeon General, heads of the CDC, the NIH, all those people that would have been in the know, all those top people, they need the perp walk right now, because pretty sure most of them will have some degree of understanding of what's going on. And like I say, their job is to the public, not to themselves. And they didn't come through when it mattered. And they've shown how expendable they think we are.
Well, I mean, even that phrase, I know it's a technical phrase, but herd immunity, meh, right? I mean, so now, but then, of course, the lawsuits, I assume, would start, right? In that, I mean, there are already people in Spain suing the Spanish government for telling everyone to go attend feminist rallies in March and saying it was no problem. Okay, so let's do a couple of questions. If you don't, you know, if it's not relevant, you don't have any answers, obviously, you know that you can just say pass, you know, in the old mastermind way when the game show when I was a kid.